we're on the forefront. We see the impacts firsthand. We see how they alter the world around us.
A group of young Alaskans file suit against the state, demanding action on climate change. From the Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 27th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, how a small test led to tons of Bristol Bay salmon getting dumped at the Anchorage landfill.
She told me that full testing could be done, but it had to be contracted. And Bristol Bay Seafoods didn't pay for that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Today ends the first week of the legislature's fourth special session. We're checking in with Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman about where things stand. Andrew, hello, and just first of all, tell me, where in the Capitol building are you?
Well, I'm in the Capitol's, the press room's little audio recording booth.
And what is happening outside the booth in the Capitol today?
Well, we have reporters working on stories and legislators kind of milling around. And basically what we've seen this week is a lot less activity than we would have seen if the Senate had stuck around. We've only seen meetings basically in the House the last couple of days. The Senate's going to be holding meetings next week in Anchorage. But for now, basically the House is working on both of the bills that Governor Paul Walker asked the legislature to consider. One bill would scale back some of the changes made last year in the major overhaul of the state's criminal justice law. And the other bill would just impose a new tax. It's 1.5% payroll tax.
Well, I want to start with the criminal justice bill because I think people are getting very confused messages about what's actually happening. So it sounds like there's SB 91, which signed into law last year. But this year, the Senate's actually considering Senate Bill 54. And explain what in the last few days they've decided to do with that.
Well, before they started work on it, what the bill would have done is basically make the penalties for committing some offenses tougher than they were under SB 91. For example, the legislature, if it passes this bill, people who commit Class C felonies like assault or threatening would expect to face up to 1 year in jail. And under SB 91, they would only see jail time if they violate their probation. What's been happening this week is the House Judiciary Committee debated amendments to the bill. And they passed 8 of those. They defeated 22 others, many, many hours of debate. The 8 amendments aren't expected to have a major budget impact, and that is probably good for the chances of the bill passing because the majorities in both houses probably don't want to see a real dramatic increase in the budget due to this bill.
Andrew, do you have a sense of where things are headed with the bill?
Well, it goes to the House Finance Committee next, and they're also considering the tax bill. Once they're done with the crime bill, it's going to go to the entire House. And that promises to be a heated floor debate. Most Republicans want the bill to go further in repealing SB 91, while most Democrats want to give the major provisions of last year's law more time. My sense is that lawmakers want to pass a bill, considering how concerned Alaskans are about crime, particularly in Anchorage.
And what about the tax bill? Wasn't that the reason that legislators were called back to Juneau in the first place, ostensibly by the governor? Where do things stand with that?
Yeah, that's basically what the session was supposed to be about before the crime issue sort of took it over. The Senate Finance Committee is scheduled to hold hearings on oil revenue, the state budget, and the permanent fund next week. Presumably, they're going to explore how large of a gap there is between what the state spends and what it brings in oil royalties, taxes, and fees. Walker's team says that the taxes needed to cover that gap. And that would be true even if the legislature were to pass another major bill that would draw money from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. The bill faces long odds in the Senate because some senators are basically hopeful that oil royalties will cover the gap like it has whenever the state's been in a budget crisis in the past.
Thank you, Andrew, for reporting from the Capitol, and thanks for talking.
Thanks a lot, Zach.
In other news out of the Capitol, the Alaska State Officers Compensation Commission voted Wednesday to cut state legislators' pay by 10%, or roughly $5,000 per year. It would be the first cut to Alaska legislators' salaries since 1987. The commission also voted to cut the amount lawmakers are paid each day during the session by roughly two-thirds, down to $78 per day. The changes will go into effect unless the Alaska legislature votes against it. A man accused of fatally shooting a state prosecutor in Utqiagvik has been convicted. A jury on Thursday found Ronald Fisher guilty of murder, assault, and resisting arrest in the 2014 incident. Fisher shot the victim, 47-year-old Brian Sullivan, twice with a shotgun. Fisher was alleged to have shot Sullivan after finding him at his ex-girlfriend's house. Fisher is scheduled to be sentenced April 6th. He's being held in jail without bail. 16 young Alaskans are suing the state, demanding the Walker administration take action on climate change. As Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, it's the second such legal action in the last 6 years.
This suit comes 3 years after the Alaska Supreme Court dismissed a similar lawsuit from young people asking the state to do something about climate change. The justices ruled then that it's not for the courts to set climate policy. Those decisions have to be made through the political process by the legislature and the governor. This new lawsuit says, essentially, the state has made its choice. And by encouraging oil development and permitting projects that emit greenhouse gases, Alaska is actively making climate change worse, violating the plaintiff's constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. Now, the suit says, it's time for the courts to intervene. Andrew Welly represents the young plaintiffs. He says they want the state to produce a plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, including from Alaska's major industries.
There needs to be a way for Alaska to address the emergency that's being compounded by its government. If that results in reductions of oil and gas extraction, that could be a component of the plan.
And he says that would likely be required. Welly works for Our Children's Trust, a nonprofit which has filed similar lawsuits in states around the country and in federal court. They also backed the previous suit in Alaska. The lead plaintiff is Esau Sinek, a 19-year-old from the community of Shishmaref on the Chukchi Sea coast. Shishmaref has voted to move the whole village from its current location on a barrier island because of rapid erosion due in part to the loss of sea ice. The lawsuit argues that climate change threatens the very existence of Sinek's home village and native culture. Seb Kurland is an 18-year-old high school senior in Juneau, also named in the lawsuit. Kurland says young Alaskans have a particular stake in how the state handles climate change.
I think a lot of young people in Alaska are very aware of this issue. We're on the forefront of it. We see the impacts firsthand. We see how they alter the world around us.
Kurland was one of 19 teenagers who filed a petition with the Department of Environmental Conservation earlier this year, asking the state to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The state denied that petition, arguing the request posed significant consequences for employment and resource development. But the Walker administration has promised that some sort of climate plan is in the works. It's not clear yet what that plan will include or when it will be released. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what happens when you find out your property was the site of a 100-year-old murder?
Not a particularly positive thing to have this place be associated with, but an interesting little nugget of history for this little place.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Anchorage landfill is now the owner of about 80 tons of highly contested Bristol Bay salmon from the Accutan. Even after a disastrous season where the boat ended up disabled, the crew was hopeful the fish could be saved and they would get paid. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has the story of how so much valuable salmon ended up going to waste.
The fishing vessel Accutan is a custom processor. This summer, it was supposed to process up to 100,000 pounds of salmon a day for Bristol Bay Seafoods LLC, a small group of fishermen. But nearly everything that could go wrong did. The vessel's owner went broke, the crew wasn't paid, and when 158,000 pounds of fish came off the boat in early September, a third-party testing group, NSF, declared it unfit for human or animal consumption. Captain Steve Leckleitner says the only test NSF ran on the fish was a sniff test, meaning the tester smelled the fish to determine it was bad.
I kind of chuckled a little bit, you know, but that's how they're certified.
Leckleitner says a representative from Bristol Bay Seafoods LLC selected the four 50-pound bags that NSF tested. That means less than 0.1% of all the fish was tested. Because the fish was so highly contested, Leckleitner says he suggested to the NSF tester that additional testing be done.
She told me that full testing could be done, but it had to be contracted. And Bristol Bay Seafoods didn't pay for that. And they didn't want the report released.
NSF declined to comment for this story, saying they wanted to keep the testing confidential. In a statement, a lawyer representing Bristol Bay Seafoods LLC said the company believes the fish was polluted sometime between mid-August and when the fish was removed from the processor in early September. The lawyer says when the fish was unloaded, 25,000 pounds were visibly saturated with fuel. Additionally, the lawyer says it's unclear whether the Accutan crew contaminated the fish on purpose or through negligence. Chief Engineer Decio Andrade says it wouldn't make sense for the crew to destroy the fish since their pay hinged on the fish going to market.
You know, to say that all the fish is condemned, all the fish has diesel in it, that's BS. There's no way the diesel ever touched the fish.
Both Andrade and Captain Leckleitner believe Bristol Bay Seafoods LLC wanted the fish to be found unsafe for consumption because it allows the company to collect on an insurance claim for the fish's full market value.
If the fish is condemned, then Bristol Bay Seafoods has an insurance claim. They would receive all of that. If it went that way, then the crew would not get paid.
Leckleitner says the Department of Labor had liens on the fish. If it had sold, he says Bristol Bay Seafoods LLC would not see any money. Instead, the funds would be used to pay the crew. The Department of Labor has declined to comment until the case is closed. In Alaska, the State Department of Environmental Conservation says it's not unprecedented to have this much fish go to waste. Since 2014, the department has ordered more than 100,000 pounds of fish destroyed at least two other times. In this case, Bristol Bay Seafoods LLC says the Anchorage landfill was the only available disposal option in the state. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
The body of a woman has been recovered downstream from Ketchikan's Carlana Lake Dam. While the body has not yet been identified, Ketchikan police say the body was found close to the last known location of a young woman missing for about a month. Police had searched the area and found some items that appeared to belong to the missing woman. The body will be sent to the state medical examiner's office for identification and to determine a cause of death. At this point, he says there's no indication of foul play. Nobel laureate economist Vernon Smith spent 3 years at the University of Alaska Anchorage late in his career, and UAA has now named the centerpiece of its experimental economics program after him. On a recent visit to Anchorage, Smith sat down with Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove to talk about his life, his work, and, among other things, how he thinks Alaska got it wrong with the permanent fund.
Vernon Smith was a C student in high school with sloppy handwriting. No one else in his family had been to college. He grew up in Kansas and helped build B-29 bombers as a teenager during World War II. But he worked hard at a local college, passed the entrance exam at Caltech, and started reading about economics.
I was really amazed. Here are the social sciences. You could do social science in a rigorous way.
Eventually, he would go on to teach at universities around the country and developed methods for conducting laboratory experiments in economics. Essentially, he created tools that didn't exist before that have allowed for a much greater understanding of how complex systems and markets are likely to behave in the real world.
So you can do experiments to answer policy questions. But the first job is to understand that world.
For Smith, understanding and getting to know Alaska started in the mid-1960s when he visited for 7 weeks of camping and fishing.
You know, I kind of fell in love with Alaska on that summer trip.
Smith returned over the years, and he was visiting Anchorage when, decades later in the early 2000s, a UAA professor asked if he'd be interested in being the first ever Rasmussen Chair of Economics. Smith agreed, but then something happened. That fall, he won a Nobel Prize. That was great, of course, for Smith, but it worried UAA.
Well, they thought I wouldn't come. Thought, well, now, you know, it's probably off because he'll be so busy, but I still wanted to come. It's something I wanted to do, and I figured I'll just make time for it.
So with Nobel in hand, Smith came to UAA and laid the groundwork for the Experimental Economics Program and the lab there that is now named after him. Over the years, with his connection to Alaska, Smith also watched the state's own grand experiment play out, as it used its oil wealth to create a permanent fund. He says the fund was a great idea and really a great model for other resource-rich states or countries. But Smith says 100% of that oil tax revenue should have gone to the fund, with an income tax to pay for state government. He says Alaskans so far have gotten a free ride. If there were a more direct connection between Alaskans' income and how government is funded, Smith says more people would be more engaged with policy decisions and government officials.
I mean, people think, well, what difference does it make? You just put it in one pocket and take it out of the other. But it goes through some sort of a ballot process, you see, so that governments don't get access to that free. They got to convince the people that they're willing to pay taxes in order to support their programs. A big difference.
At this point, years down the road, Smith says an income tax will be a hard sell. And with the legislature again taking up the issue, it could be another Alaska economics experiment still playing out. In Anchorage, I'm Casey Grove.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, murder. For our Halloween edition of AK, we revisit the scene of the crime, the site of a cold-blooded murder that took place more than 100 years ago in Juneau. KTOO's Matt Miller spent the summer researching what happened when the Birdman of Alcatraz killed for the first time.
Robert F. Straub. Breaking that train window was a serious offense.
It was hot. I was thinking of my lungs.
That's Carl Malden and Burt Lancaster in the 1962 movie Birdman of Alcatraz. That's based on the book of the same name. Lancaster plays Robert Stroud, perhaps the country's most notorious inmate.
You know, I think I've got you figured out, Shoemaker. First day I came here, you as much as asked me to get down on my knees and whimper. I wouldn't do it then, I won't do it now. I won't lick your hand, and that's what eats you, ain't it, Keeper? Well, you keep this in mind. A man ain't whipped until he quits, and I'll never give you that pleasure.
While incarcerated at Leavenworth Prison in Kansas, Stroud took in a few birds and nursed them back to health. That led to a small cottage industry of bird care remedies and one of the first and most widely regarded books on bird diseases and bird care. Stroud was forced to end his study of birds when he was transferred to Alcatraz in San Francisco. He landed there because he murdered two men, the first in downtown post-Gold Rush Juneau.
In 1909 in Alaska, you appointed yourself judge, jury, and executioner and killed one Charles Donner because he allegedly beat up a friend named Katie Malone, a prostitute.
Stroud met his girlfriend Kate Delaney in Cordova in 1908. Delaney, also known as Kitty O'Brien, was a dance hall girl among her various occupations. A few sensational accounts paint Stroud as Delaney's pimp, but Stroud was only 18 years old, and according to Thomas Gaddis's book, Birdman of Alcatraz, was completely inexperienced with women until he met Delaney. She was twice his age and probably bonded with Stroud when she nursed him back to health after a bout of pneumonia. Stroud and Delaney left Cordova and followed one of Delaney's acquaintances to Juneau. Charles Dahmer had become a bartender at the Montana Saloon. I asked Leo Helmar to help me retrace the events of the murder. Helmar is a paralegal at the City and Borough of Juneau's Department of Law. He also just started a podcast called Murder Alaska.
A lot of the things about Robert Stroud have sort of passed into the realm of myth. Like the fact that he's called the Birdman of Alcatraz is not accurate at all. For example, he didn't have birds at Alcatraz.
Helmar and I walked through downtown Juneau to find the Montana Saloon and Delaney's crib in Juneau's old red light district.
You know, apparently there's some previous relationship there between Delaney and Dahmer. Obviously that was a flashpoint with Stroud for whatever reason.
Some accounts say Dahmer stiffed Delaney on money that he owed her, but according to Gaddis, Dahmer wanted Delaney to stay with him. He assaulted her, gave her black eyes, and took a gold locket with her daughter's picture after ripping it from around her neck. Stroud came back to her room, became enraged, and took Delaney's revolver when she passed out drunk. Stroud bought some ammunition and headed up the hill to Dahmer's cottage several blocks away. Stroud and Dahmer fought. Stroud fired a shot and missed. He fired again into Dahmer's temple and down into his pelvis. A neighbor heard the two shots and watched Stroud leave Dahmer's house. Stroud returned the locket and gun to Delaney's room and then turned himself in to the local marshal.
It's so interesting to try to do historical reconstruction because, you know, a lot of times you just don't have all the info you'd like to do. You don't have all the photos and stuff like that.
At the murder scene, I venture inside the current house on the lot and talk with Eric Jorgensen. His firm, Earth Justice, bought the house back in the late 1980s.
Well, it's a little oddity about living and working here, I guess.
Jorgensen recalls a rather macabre tourist walking tour stopping in the adjacent lot years ago. He wasn't entirely sure, but he presumed it was about the murder and Birdman of Alcatraz.
Not a particularly positive thing to have this place be associated with, but an interesting little nugget of history for this little place.
Instead of standing trial after his arrest, Stroud pled out to a manslaughter charge and was sentenced to 12 years in prison. Initially incarcerated at McNeil Island in Washington, he was considered one of the most violent prisoners there. Stroud spent the rest of his life in the federal prison system, including well over four decades in solitary confinement.
Will they allow you to work with birds where you're going?
I'm afraid not. In the eyes of the prison bureau, avian research is, as you boys might put it, for the birds.
For AK, I'm Matt Miller reporting in Juneau.
Now it's time for 49 Voices, and we're keeping the Halloween theme going with Carissa Pierce, who writes under the moniker The Fermented Alaskan. Pierce lives in Anchorage, but creates drink recipes for the New Orleans-based company Tales of the Cocktail, and we got her to share some of her favorite Halloween-inspired concoctions.
Mm-hmm.
I go out and hike and pick blueberries and cranberries and golden berries and salmon berries, and I'll turn it into liqueur. So my friends kept asking me to make more, and I started making more, and then they're like, well, you should make cocktails out of these. Halloween is my favorite holiday, so I do a party every year at my house, and it's all Halloween-themed drinks. So I do candy corn cocktails and Sour Patch Kid shots, and I'll use some of my infusions in there and pop a little piece of dry ice in it so it's all smoky and spooky. The cider, it's super easy. You can get your favorite brand, and I'll put it in a pot on the stove, and I dump an entire 16-ounce bag of Brock's Cinnamon Red Disc candies in it, and I'll heat it up and stir it until it melts, and then I just stick a ladle in there, and people can come up and get their own cider, and it's cinnamony and delicious. I also, for the alcoholic version, I will add whiskey to it. My favorite Halloween cocktail is a spin-off, The Corpse Reviver, and I call it The Walking Dead. So it's I infused gin with fresh cherries, and then I have lemon thyme infused gin that I mix with it. I put an orange liqueur, which I use Grand Marnier. You can use other orange liqueurs if you want. I use Lillet, which is a fortified wine, fresh lemon juice, and orange blossom water spray on the top, and I pop a piece of dry ice in there. And it's mind-blowing, the flavors. I do love candy, so if I can, you know, stick a Reese's Pieces and infuse it and make a cocktail out of it, it's fun for me. I get to play a little bit and act like a little kid, so.
Carissa Pierce lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Matt Miller and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Casey Grove produced tonight's show, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com. The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Juneau, October 31st through November 2nd at Elizabeth Paratrovich Hall from 8:30 to 5. To discuss proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and other issues related to subsistence, the public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.